Hello and welcome to Rural Report. I'm Jaspreet Bopara here with Don Nicholson. And as you see, both of us got the memo to wear white shirts. One's are slightly more ironed than the other. Hi, Don.
I don't think you should be too tough on yourself on that. It's the style you've got. So look, I've got the iron shirt. Yeah, thank you. My dear wife, she irons my shirt religiously, although I can do that. I'm not useless. But anyway, hey, look, great to be back. And we should also alert our listeners and viewers to the, we don't bring up the regular sort of front and center rural news every week. We're trying to bring out the more obscure sort of stories, and hopefully you enjoy them.
The ones that you don't see on mainstream. Yep.
So what's top of that list this week, Jaspreet?
Well, I'm going to, at the risk of repeating myself, I am going to repeat myself. And in case you are listening to Dawn and me on Tuesday or early on Wednesday, so that is the 25th or the 26th, you still have some time to drop an email to the Department of Conservation about their proposed subject, the proposed topic for their long-term insights briefing. So let me share my screen here, as I did in the past, and show you what I mean. So these submissions on the DOCS website are available under the open consultations. So DOC wants your feedback, but there is no submission form. There's an email address here where they ask you to email your thoughts about this being the topic over the next few years, setting direction. How can the value of nature be better integrated into government decision making? And what novel approaches can be taken to better incorporate the value of nature into government decision making in Aotearoa, New Zealand? And if you are sending an email, please note if you could just pop in one line saying that you would be interested to be kept up to date into the mid-year, further how this progresses. It would be good because, as we've warned in the past, our repeat guests have warned, especially our interviews with Margaret Byfield, what they are doing here is trying to monetize nature, trying to create a new asset class, an asset class of nature, which, incidentally, the Americans beat last year. They've tried to do something similar in USA, call them NACs, the Natural Asset Companies. Our interviews with Margaret Byfield, if you go back and listen to them, we've spoken about this extensively. But basically, we are not just happy and content at stopping at monetizing CO2. We want to create further money out of thin air, don't we, Don?
Yeah, that seems to be the target. Of course, over the weekend, we saw that there was 200 million being allocated to sort of renature parts of New Zealand, including Stewart Island. And you sort of wonder how that's going to be funded, but maybe it links into this somehow, does it, Jasper, do you think?
I saw that myself and this an organization called the Oceans Conservation International, Don. So there are three islands that they propose to conserve, preserve, get predator-free, whatever you may call it. I think it's the Great Barrier Island, the Stewart Island, and when which one is it? The Chathams.
Maybe. No, it might have been Waiheke. I'm just not sure, actually.
Okay,
But yes, 200
I do
million
know
anyway.
Stewart
Yeah,
Island
anyway,
is
it's.
one
Is
of
there a
them.
linkage? Is there a linkage to this, do you think?
Well, Hollywood is coming to New Zealand on one of these organizations that's tying up, and they just want a paltry 200 odd million, not much, is called Rewild. And the founder of Rewild is Leonardo DiCaprio. What could go wrong? Isn't it
What could
funny how
go?
most of Hollywood has turned environmentalists? They know where the money is. But I digress. This is what Department of Conservation wants you to email them on, whether you agree with the fact that we should be valuing nature better. And just to show you how absurd this is the website of ECOS. ECOS is another such provider that helps you buy carbon credits and biodiversity credits in New Zealand. But from you can shop from overseas. You can even buy credits from a little forest in a remote part of India, the Khasi Hills, where I've been about 40 years ago as a young child. God, I'm old. But what have we done? Look at this. The ECOS has a already has a biocreditor program in New Zealand based on the one of the SDGs, life on land. And they have floated something called as the ECOS, Sustainable Development Units. What a surprise! Which are measurable, verified units to fund and support projects aligned with the United Nations. Now, I have no problem with people doing good to save the world. And like these Khasi Hills, where I said that they are selling you credits in New Zealand out of those forests in India, it is essentially monetizing those forests. Some other native tribes there have conserved them, but a corporate in New Zealand can just go there and buy them and essentially tick off some ESG pointers on their balance sheets. And when ECOS is asked, just like the Department of Conservation, are you not just commodifying and exploiting nature by trading forest protection? They say no. Firstly, nature has been commodified long ago in the form of forest and wood and so on and so forth. We are simply pricing the human labor and technology to care for and restore nature even more. We are not exploiting nature any more than a doctor is exploiting a patient to combat disease. We are just using a market instrument to raise money. Wherein is my problem? They are raising money by literally, it's money out of thin air. And if Department of Conservation decides to go down the same path, they have already set precedent by their previous consultations, Don, biodiversity credits and all of that. It is pretty much game, set, match.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And of course, if you're the government, you would be saying, always DOC is underfunded. They've always need more money. If you're the government of the day, you're going to say, this is great. We'll get DOC off our back. We'll let someone else pick up the tab and, let this credit system play out. And, as I've said to you before, some of these guys that are developing these systems, they'd trade the toenails off your grandmother. They are really crazy. They really annoy me. I like real stuff. I like trading in real stuff, or tangible stuff. This is an intangible. And they've created a legislative framework for themselves. And to me, we've got to stop it. But there we go.
Trading in toenails, that's a new one.
Yeah, there's. They're a scarce commodity when you get older, I tell you. Anyway,
Right. So
so look.
if you've just watched this before the end of the day of the 26th of February, please go to the Department of Conservation website and drop them an email, even if it's just to say you do not agree.
And of course, Jaspreet, on the other side of it, some of the private owners, so we're talking about DOC here, but on the other side, if you're a private landowner and you're so constantly getting harassed and harangued by society that you need to do XYZ to protect that remnant bush or don't drain a wetland or something, hopefully farmers aren't doing so much of that anymore anyway. You can't blame people for saying, oh, okay, someone's prepared to put some cash in my pocket. And of course, you could argue that the QE, and I did argue this a couple of weeks ago, that the QE2 Trust, which is, lauded as a really good conservation
Initiative.
exhibit, has now just got another, I think it's 4.5 million out of the taxpayer to keep itself going. Now, if perhaps those owners of that land had their remnant bush monetized, maybe they would get off the taxpayers' back as well. I mean, double-edged sword, this stuff. But when you see the national inventory of, say, the DOC lands, what's under that land, the monetization of everything. And we're not just talking the trees and the nature and the foliage. We're talking, when we're talking nature credits, away from this DOC story, the Americans were even talking about photosynthesis and pollination and you name it. Anything that a fast money person could get their hand on, they were going to try and monetize. And on the other side of it, if you're supposedly an indigenous
Native, a tribe.
your tribe, you're going to have your hand out. Because you look at it, the Aborigines in Australia, they want it. I imagine Maori in New Zealand want this. For their for to benefit their balance sheets. And then again, we're into that next thing that I get really upset about, the separate economies in this country, like the Maori separate economy. Yeah, we better not start on that this week.
I'll take your
But
word for
anyway,
it.
good that you've put everyone on notice. Help Jaspreet out. She's put a lot of effort into this. Make sure you get your emails in by the 26th.
If this would have led to the improvement of something, Don, I would have no problem. But what this is specifically doing, it's, growing up, our economics, I was taught the standard of living of a country is directly proportional to the productivity of its people. There is no productivity involved in this. This is just creative accounting at its finest here.
Well, as you sent me something today about there'll be two sets of accounting for a farmer one day, and I chided
Right,
you a little
let's
bit, saying that's already there. Our cooperatives are almost putting two sets of accounts in now, one for the financials and one for the sustainability paradigms.
Glad you've reminded me of that one. So what Don is referring to is a paper I read from this recent agricultural, should I call it agricultural, agri-tech conference in Queensland this last week just gone. It's called Evoke Ag. And I wonder why, because in those sanitized flash halls, there's not a lot of farming that I could see. This whole lot is about tech and technology and ESG and carbon credits and all of that. So this was the Evoke Ag Conference in Queensland, and one of the speakers there, esteemed speaker, was Impact Ag Australia's managing director and CEO, Hugh Killen, who said that the farm of the future isn't farming just farming. Farm of the future will need two balance sheets, one for valuing agriculture production and the other for valuing the natural capital. And that is why you're going to need those valuations soon. And Victoria was recently played host late last year to the Nature Positive Summit, where again it was about valuing nature and putting through a taxonomy to create this new asset class. Very slippery slope there. And that's why I say these ag conferences these days is just more gobbledygook for me. This is not farming, getting your hands dirty, as one would have thought. And don't get me wrong here, Don. I know you think I'm against everything tech. I am not. But when people start talking this sort of nonsense in an ag conference, I know they know exactly which side of the bread is buttered.
Yeah, sure. And I do know we've both got views about technology and the use of technology to develop smarter systems. I love efficiency drivers, things that make my job as a farmer better, easier, smarter. The trouble is, if you need, and I know I'm a stuck record on this, if you need legislation to actually encourage that, then it's all wrong. And of course, there'll be a lot of grifters in behind the proposal in Australia to lift ag exports, feeding the machine, so to speak. I think, in fact, I think the government is kicked off with a $5 billion future drought fund in 2019. Farmers know what droughts are. And I hopefully that there is a way to predict the next drought, but I'm not sure they've ever nailed that. But you just know that there's going to be a lot of people sucking at that teat, and it won't actually advance the cause of agriculture at all. And by the way, just as we factoid here, it amazed me that Queensland was talking about sowing the seeds to get their earnings from agriculture, the primary sector, up to 30 billion. And in fact, over Australia, 100 billion by perhaps the next few years. And it's interesting. Look at the size of Australia compared to New Zealand. We've got our export earnings or our earnings from the primary sector in the mid 50 billion bracket. It's interesting. We do very, very well as a small country's primary producers, and we should be lauded for it instead of chastised as we often are by certain sectors. But anyway, it was just a small thing. I thought the Australian export earnings would have been significantly higher than they are from the primary sector. Of course, they've got mining too, and coal exports and iron ore and stuff. So anyway, that conference, I know it wound you up. There's a lot of New Zealand companies there. One was Ravensdown, the fertilizer company in New Zealand's got a company there called Agnition. and there was a few other New Zealand companies, and yeah, they all got sort of lauded as having good ideas. So let's see
But
what.
the bottom line of the conference, John, when I was reading it, said we are working to prepare the global agri-food sector for our new climate reality. Without the climate crisis, this lot have nothing, and they must harp on and harp on about it ad nauseum. And one wonders, like in the US, it's taken the administration just a handful of weeks to stop everything climate related, whereas here it's like crickets, nothing is changing. We have today, the news came out about the consultation with a few select stakeholders on the hiking of the what is it, the natural hazards levy. So the EQC, which is now the Natural Hazards Commission, and that's going to result in substantial hikes for homeowners up and down this country.
Incredible. I think I read where that was going from 16 cents per $100 of capital value to potentially a range of between 22 and 26 cents. So we're talking at least a fifth, near a 50% increase in one hit. Owning property in this country is not just that pleasant, is it? Between local authority rates and levies such as this, and it makes you wonder why there's never enough. I mean, I like to be self-reliant, but we're feeding a big machine here, and it looks like it needs the machine to get bigger. And moreover, if it does get bigger, does that take the pressure off the real insurance companies? Sort of who can perhaps limit their premiums and put the new risk or the next level of risk in monetary terms back on the levy, and within this levy effectively. So you're covering non-insured people as well. I don't know. I find it it's an easy thing to just tick that box and say, let's increase it. Let's hope they're doing a whole lot more research.
Looking at the natural hazards portal.gov.nz.govt.nz, again, there's this whole thing about climate change exacerbating the natural hazards and how climate change is inundating lower-lying coastal properties and will cause many more to be at a higher risk of coastal flooding, coastal erosion, cliff collapse, tsunami risk, so on and so forth. The only thing it doesn't seem to touch is the volcanic activity, but non-eruptive volcanic hazards such as lahars may increase with more extreme weather. So there's nothing that is not touching this. When people say that they don't see on their itemized bill where's the cost of climate change, it is being built into every single thing, every
If
single government, all of these levies and invoices that you see.
everyone got the exposure on things on their local authority rates, on the RMA's influence through those rates, or some other process like, for instance, within farm compliance regimes, if everyone was able to see down to the minute eye where their dollars went, they would be absolutely shattered. It's intriguing when you apply for a building consent or a resource consent. Some councils ask for an upfront payment before you can even challenge it. So you actually have to put what looks to be a sizable chunk of cash in, and then hope that they can justify it later on. Now, no doubt they will justify it if you're on $250 an hour. You will justify a $10,000 application fee somehow with 25 hours of work or 50 hours of work. So that point you've just made, Jaspreet, is what is a key element of my life. Put the real costs in front of people so they can assess it and see what the value proposition is. But you're right, Jaspreet, mostly people don't get that unless it's in a private transaction, you and me perhaps buying and selling, trading something or going to a shop. But through the government or local government agencies, we don't see it.
No, we just don't see it. And IPCC itself admits that it doesn't have those climate signals to say that what is going to happen in the, beyond 2100. But somehow our Natural Hazards Commission, our Climate Change Commission, all of them have found this, that yeah, we know exactly what's going to come. And
Well, that's the modeling. Modeling, and of course, recently we've read where There's some modelers starting to backtrack on their climate models that by 2100 we will not get the level of temperature increase because it's been overstated by a factor of, I think it was five at the worst end. So I gather there's hundreds of thousands of different models that can make up these permutations. But when you read people like Dr. Matthew Wielecki or Roger Pielki Jr., they talk about it exactly like you did before, Jaspreet. There is no signals in the last 100 years, apart from a slight increase in temperature, that suggests that natural disasters are getting worse.
Worse.
There's just no signal. I know we've had some in New Zealand that are really stressful for people, but remember, we've got more people living in built-up areas, so it affects more people, and that's a common thread through the disasters that have happened in the world, where there's more people around. Anyway, yeah, look at once you get a levy increase, yeah, just don't get it to backtrack. You know how
No,
that
just
works.
don't get it. You just don't get it to backtrack. The people just, we don't think, we just think that this is invoice that's come and that's what it's inflation and it's everything else, but it's far more than that.
It is. But hey, if you're a Fonterra farmer supplier at the moment, you'll be skipping and jumping. You're going to get this massive payout for being a compliant little chap, yes. You're going to get a bonus for meeting your emissions profiling under the, was it Te Puku regime? That
So
sounds like filling your stomach. I don't know.
I think those ones don't Fonterra's had for a while. 10 cents
Yes.
in total over these three. Most of them have been pretty much, in my experience, pretty much just ticking over what you're already doing. But on the top of it, there's this news that came last week that Nestle is going to be giving some select New Zealand farmers 300 to 350 odd farmers will be getting an extra couple of cents of payout per kilogram milk solid. So on a $10 estimated payout, a couple of cents more. And for meeting certain extra greening targets. And this is big businesses ticking off their ESG profiles. And if I look at Nestle, where does most, what do I associate with chocolates? Candies and all of that. If you think that, tick boxing a few more of these and it's a couple of cents, it's voluntary now, watch the space. There will come a time when all of this will become mandatory for that truck pickup. And that's what happens, isn't it? We just keep just going along, going along. It's voluntary till it isn't. Where did we see that during the COVID years, Don?
Yeah, everything becomes normalized. It's interesting, those 300 farmers, those top liners, you might say, that have hit the right credentials to get the extra bonus. Their milk, I'm sure, just gets mixed up with every other droplet of milk in the regime of processing. So the fact that Nestle or Mars think that it's the right thing to do seems almost irrelevant when you know that you can't separate droplets of milk when they're picked up and merged into a whole morass of milk powder or whatever it is that you're getting. So, to me, it's a crock of the proverbial, but they're
I
getting
don't
away
know,
with
Don.
it.
One
And
day
they've
there may be low emissions candy bars.
make all the difference to the people eating them. And of course, they've spent 20 years building to this. Fonterra was formed in 2001 with an act of parliament giving it the privilege. So here we are 24 years on. They have been slowly, it's been a slow burn, but they're getting there. They're getting there. And all under the coercion of the governments of the day. None of them have said, we're going to back this off. We're going to rein this regime in. It's just moving on. And of course, here we have Winston Peters now posturing like David Seymour, that they think we should pull out of Paris like Donald Trump has done, although, as David Seymour said, maybe it's an election issue for next year. He's not willing to say, let's do it right now, like Winston Peters is. So there's a bit of posturing going on. What would happen if all this fell away, Jaspreet? What would happen if all the green grift under climate was to fall away? I mean,
People would have
today,
to look for real jobs, Don, not just creative accounting ones then.
you and I saw a post for a guy we interviewed last year, Roger Chiazza from New York. He highlighted at the end of that article where a little NGO with an asset base of $100 was able to seduce $2 billion worth of funding out of the Biden regime. I mean, that's the sort of stuff that's going on under all this climate stuff around the world. I can't say how quantified in New Zealand only, but this is deep. This climate swamp is deep. And we will, if we were to unbundle it, I think we would find a whole lot of a lot of users in there. So I don't know. You don't think it's going to be possible to unbundle this, though, do you? I can tell by the look in your
Oh, there's no reality check like an economic reality check.
Yeah, it could
And
be.
it comes to the best of them. But I think we need to, this one I really want to talk about, so I'm going to interrupt head on. This new rollout that a New Zealand Parliament has decided of the carbon capture pipeline infrastructure. So
Yeah,
many viewers would
what a
possibly
rort.
not know what this is, but this is capturing carbon, I can't even say that with a straight face.
Dioxide.
Capturing carbon dioxide, putting it underground, and claiming credits for it for somehow having done your bit for nature. This is what we have come to. And while the rest of the world pulls back to from it, our beehive on the 21st of February put this brief out, Minister Simon Watts, that the government has made key decisions on CCUS. Carbon capture utilization and storage frameworks to enable business from benefit from storing carbon underground, which will support our whole goal of reducing carbon emissions, all based on the premise, of course, that carbon is going to kill you, carbon dioxide is going to kill you. They seem to just completely forget that in the rest of the world, time and time again, carbon capture systems, pipelines, whatever they've done, have not really proven very successful. They have been dangerous at times. And even the IPCC, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, states in its special report on these carbon capturing systems that CO2 storage is not necessarily permanent. Physical leakage from storage reservoirs is possible via gradual and long-term release or sudden release of CO2 caused by disruption of the reservoirs. They have spoken to American guests like Tom DeWeese from the American Policy Center, who's been leading the fight against the carbon capture pipelines that are hampering farmers in Iowa and I believe other Midwest states. We seem to think it's going to work head on. It's like, I don't know. We've got, people with fingers in their ears, not listening, not seeing, pretending everything is fine in the world, and let us continue being guinea pigs along this way.
Well, there's a lot of greenbacks. You just imagine when some of that's leaking out. Will they be looking for compensation?
There'll be accountants running around to see how do we now account for these.
And little old New Zealand has got quite a sense, a large fault line running through part of it. I mean, we're not prone to having earth moving in New Zealand, are we? So, look, I'm not no geologist, but this is nonsense. I heard about it about 25 years ago. I thought it was nonsense then, and nothing has told me it's not to this day. Now, prove me wrong, I'll be happy. But as I said, 25 years,
We
I
keep
can't
talking
see
about
it.
the AFA, don't we? I've heard a lot about that, the Alpine Fault of magnitude 8 that could disrupt everything. Well, if there's some carbon buried somewhere and that suddenly leaks out. Don, you probably have the vintage to tell about this leakage that happened in Africa with disaster consequences, and that was a natural.
Oh, well, no. CO2, as we've talked about before, is the fertilizer of life. But gee, if you get too much of it, more than 400, it's 420 parts per million right now. If you get it in a really concentrated area in an inversion layer, like happened in Cameroon in 1986, there was 1,600 people asphyxiated by carbon dioxide leakage. They're just couldn't escape. It escaped out of the carbon dioxide escaped out of the storage system, and the inversion layer in the atmosphere held it down. And these people, sadly, and their animals all around them died.
And that was, I mean, sort of a natural phenomena. So what are we talking about here? But yeah, as I said, whenever people pretend, they go along with nonsense, one should just prefix that with the adjective. It must be lucrative nonsense.
Yeah. So look, there's a lot of news that you might not deduce as perhaps from rural or detectors from rural areas, but it affects us all. It affects us all. And my hobby horse at the moment is the glacial pace of the RMA reforms. Yeah, we were promised these so many times by so many governments, and I thought this coalition was going to get out of bed quick and have it done. Last September, they put out Minister Bishop and I think Minister, I forget his title, Under Secretary, or a subordinate minister, Simon Court, put out this press. They did a big speech and they talked about two phases. Well, I think we're getting phased out. We need to get this phased in really quickly. And one part of it that really annoyed me, it was part six. They're talking about how they are going to give farmer organizations, primary industry organizations, the rights to manage or audit and set up and audit their own farm plans. That's like saying we agreed with farm plans. Whoever did? I don't know. Where was the voluntary farm plan caper? Where's that gone? We've got groundswell, we've got beef and lamb, we've got feeds, we've got all these people saying, oh, this is all okay. So they've just fallen, in my opinion, if this goes through, they've just fallen in another hole. Basically said, yes, we can, and been caught out.
I can't say I'm surprised, John. We should not, it should have been called out unequivocally as useless that this is something we are not doing. And we will do our best, but not falling into the trap of a standardized plan, regardless of, because that's one more compliance hoop. But our industry lobby bodies have mentioned, haven't they?
Well,
Constantly talking about this.
they've said all along they didn't want mandated plans, but
And
so by
here's the
inference they were okay with voluntary, and of course voluntary is now being incorporated into the new RMA, which is not voluntary. It's an act of parliament. So
maybe
look,
a few more
that's
might.
my warning. It's my warning. Sorry, we've got a slight delay in our internet here, but it's my warning system, and I'm surprised that this, I think it's section six of these reforms, is talking about that. And look, I hope fed farmers and others are onto it. But hey, that's not sexy, that stuff. I know, not sexy. So perhaps we should wrap it.
And some farmers might remember this when there's voting underway as a part of Beef and Lamb's annual meeting, and there is this proposal to hike their directors' fees. Maybe some people remember this sort of stuff, the fact
Yeah.
that plans are not going to be implemented by their own levy bodies when they're seeing which way they vote.
Yeah, look, and just all of that, Jaspreet. And I remember I tried to set up a concept a few years ago called GAS. It was a giant agrarian swindle. And no one grasped that but me, maybe you. And I often thought, what does it take to get people active and incite a bit of
And stand up for their own rights.
stand up for their own rights, stand up for the property right. I don't get it. You try to make something sort of humorous, funny, but no, it didn't work. So look, we could hopefully we make a difference by every time we talk about this stuff. We would like to think we get one person at a time.
Absolutely. And well, it's nearly time for Don and me to wrap up. Before I go, once again, if you're watching this before the end of day of the 26th of February, please go to the Department of Conservation's website, go to their open submissions, and pop in an email about their long-term insights briefings direction where they want to value nature, and take that as a theme for the next few years. Thank you so much for joining Don and me today. Hope you have a great rest of the week. We'll see you in a week's time. Goodbye.
Yeah.